Hello everybody, welcome to Hold the Line. My name's Joe and I'm a British force-free gundog trainer. You can check out my online courses at forcefreegundog.com. The newest course is called Training the T-Drill. You can also pick up a copy of my book called Force-Free Gundog Training, The Fundamentals for Success, which is available on Amazon's everywhere around the world. There's also an accompanying workbook to record your training sessions in. I'm currently working on a sequel to Force-Free Gundog Training, and I hope it's going to be out maybe in about 6 months. We'll see. That's all for now. Let's get on with the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Hold the Line. So I've been hard at work and I have finished another course for my online site, forcefreegundog.com. The course I've just finished is called Training the T-Drill. That is not a very imaginative title for the course, but I had to give it a title which adequately summed up what it's about, and I think I've achieved that there. So I have a discount code for you guys for this course, just to kind of celebrate its launch. But I'm going to talk first of all about what the T-Drill is about and just some sort of general T-Drill waffle, really, before I give you that code so that you all understand why you need this course. So let's get on with the show. All right, so the T-Drill, let's talk a little bit about it. Who is the T-Drill for? The T-Drill is really for any gun dog which needs to learn how to handle on blind retrieves. This is any dog that you might want to send out in a straight line, stop, and then be able to cast left or right, or back left or back right. So if you want to achieve that with your dog, this is a super duper important drill for you. Who is it not for? Well, if you have a dog that you want to just do a sort of hunt up everywhere blind retrieve, then it's not going to be a course for you. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you live in North America and, for example, you, enter NAVDA events, then you might be familiar with a NAVDA duck hunt where the dog just basically independently, and that's very important, independently hunts up an area with persistence and confidence, and they just keep searching and searching and searching under their own steam without any help from the handler until they locate the bird. So that kind of retrieve I call a sort of hunt up everywhere kind of blind retrieve. And it really rests on the dog to have to take the initiative and to have an excellent nose and to locate the game. And the handler isn't giving the dog a line, isn't stopping the dog, isn't casting the dog, isn't giving the dog any information about where they will find the retrieve. So if you've got that kind of dog or you plan to compete in that kind of event or venue, then this isn't the course for you. But if you have a dog that you want to perform a blind retrieve that does involve handling, then this is the course for you. And in the UK, at least, it's expected that HBRs, Spaniels, and Retrievers can handle. So this would be a course for all of those subgroups of dog. I hope that that makes sense. But if you are worried about if the course is for you, then, you know, do drop me an email or send me a message via the site and I can just, you know, confirm it or let you know. And by the way, there is a 30-day money-back refund for any of the courses on my site. So if you do buy a course because you think it's going to be relevant for you and then you find out actually it's not, then just drop me an email. So there's no harm in kind of trying courses out, as it were. So the T-Drill, what does it involve? Well, I think the name T is a little bit misleading, because when we say the T-Drill, it's usually written as a capital T. So, you know, if you all picture a capital T in your head, that's actually not quite the shape of the T-Drill. If you picture a small t in your head, like a lowercase t, that's also not usually the shape of the T-Drill, because that has a little tick at the bottom of the T. The shape which really represents the T-Drill most adequately is really a crucifix shape. That is the shape which the dog is going to be running on the ground. So it's kind of a long line up the middle, and then there's another line which bisects that long line. So we have a position where we stand with a dog at the bottom of the long line, and we have the back post opposite us. That's the other end of the long line. And then we have our left and right on either side of a line that bisects that long line. I hope this makes sense. It's really difficult describing these things using words. So let's talk about the T-drill a little bit. So what do we need to have working before we can begin the T-drill? Because I think that some people are going to get excited about the release of this course. I'm going to rush out and grab, take advantage of this discount that I have on the T-drill course, which I've just finished. And then they're going to realize that actually their dog can't do it. And there are certain skills their dog needs to have before beginning this course. And that's what I want you to understand so that you can make sure that you've got those skills working. So the skills that your dog needs to have in order to be able to begin the T-drill are, firstly, an understanding of blind retrieves, a basic understanding of blind retrieves. So that means that your dog understands how to run to a white fence post over a reasonable distance, maybe 50 to 80 yards. And so, you know, you can stick a white fence post in the ground and either with bumpers or dummies around the base of it, or if you prefer, if your dog prefers, with food on a soup ladle strapped to the white fence post or a little bowl strapped to the white fence post, you can send your dog to the white fence post and they can either eat that food or they can retrieve a bumper from the base of it and bring it back to you. So that is, you know, an understanding of white fence posts as being desirable objectives. That's the first skill that your dog needs to have. And that is on our blind retrieves course. So on my website, Blind Retrieves, we cover that and a lot more on the blind retrieves course. Then your dog needs to have an understanding of three-handed casting. So three-handed casting refers to the dog sitting facing you and you're at a distance from the dog and the dog being able to understand your casts left, right, back left and back right to three fence posts around them. So the dog understands what your arm movements mean and they understand which fence post that means that they should run to. And with the back fence post, they understand which shoulder they should turn over to go to the back fence post. So this material is on the first steps in three-handed casting course, which I have on my website. So obviously we've got two bits of what we need there. We've got the dog running out and we've got the dog being able to be directed. The bit that we don't have is the stop. So we need to have a dog which can be stopped as they're running out. So we can blow our sit whistle and the dog can stop and then we can give them their cast. So the material for the stop, the remote stop, is on my remote stop course, which is on my website. So with those three feeder courses, blind retrieves, remote stop, and first steps in three-handed casting, you will have all the skills that you need to have to be able to successfully begin training the T-drill, which is the course that I've just finished. Now, the training the T-drill course is actually, it's a pretty simple course to give you guys and to put together, because once you've got those fundamental skills from those other three courses I mentioned, it's not a big deal to put it together and be able to run the T-drill. And so you're doing most of the work on those other courses, and then you're just, you know, reaping the benefits and seeing it all come together with training the T-drill. So difficult points to talk about when it comes to training the T-drill. I think the most difficult thing, well, there are a few difficult corners actually, but the most difficult corner, the one that a lot of people struggle with, is this idea of the dog anticipating the stop. So people often say, you know, my dog runs out and slows down and stops by themselves before I've even peeped the whistle, or my dog just walks out really slowly because they know that I'm going to peep the whistle. And all of these problems come from a lack of confidence and from the dog anticipating the stop whistle. So there are other things that can happen. So some dogs just won't go at all because they know you're about to peep the whistle and they experience that as an aversive or as slightly punishing. So they don't want to do the thing which leads to the to the punishment, i.e. run out from your side. Sometimes dogs will bug, so they won't look along your hand. You put your hand out to try and point them towards the back post and they won't look along your hand. They're just looking everywhere else. They don't want to do the exercise. They're telling you they don't want to participate. They don't want to play the training game with you because they know what it's going to lead to, the stop. And they don't want to do that. So what happens? Why does this happen, this anticipation of the stop? Well, anticipation happens because dogs are looking ahead and they're predicting what is about to happen. And dogs predict what is about to happen based on what has happened in the past. So if you start to stop the dogs too much, I don't know if that makes sense. But yeah, if you stop the dogs too much, then they're going to anticipate being stopped. So the dog is going to start to think, oh, I'm about to be stopped again because I've just been stopped three consecutive times every other time I've been sent out. So what you have to do here to achieve a stylish, fast, impressive run to the back post, which is one of your objectives with the T-drill, is you need to be able to keep running that, not stopping the dog. You need the dog to believe that the back post is where the reinforcers always are. And this is an important thing to get your head around. So often new trainers, when they're beginning teaching the T-drill, think that it's all about teaching stop and cast. And they just keep stopping the dog and casting the dog and stopping the dog and casting the dog. And they create this massive problem where the dog pops or stops or doesn't go. And, you know, to avoid that, it's pretty simple. You just need to let the dog actually run to the back post a sufficient number of times for your particular dog that they stop anticipating it. And this is something, really important to understand. So the reason that your dog will, if they do, run out confidently and stylishly and, you know, look like they have an objective, which is the back post, is because that's what they have. They have that as an objective. And so they need to believe in that moment that that's where they're going. When your dog leaves your side in the T-drill, they always need to believe that they're going to the back post, even if you're going to stop them. Whatever happens, they need to believe fully 150% that the back post is where they're going. And they need to believe that until the minute you stop them. So you need to do whatever you have to do to keep your dog believing that the back post is where they're going. So that might mean with some dogs, if they lack confidence, you might need to send them 4 or 5 reps to the back post and stop them once. And that might be all you can do in a session, because if you start to stop them more than once, they start to lack confidence and do no-goes or, you know, all the rest of it. So you might, on the other hand, have a really sort of drivey, confident dog which just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes infinitely. My little black Labrador Moy was a bit like that. Then for those dogs, you probably can do one to the back post and then one stop and cast and then one to the back post and then one stop and cast. And they will just keep going, 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 going. So the individual dog brings a lot to the table here in terms of how many reps they're able to do in terms of being stopped and cast before they start to show a lack of confidence or believe that they're about to be stopped. So the individual dog brings a lot to the table, but you have to work with the dog that you have, obviously. You can't treat the dog that you have as if they're a more confident dog than they are. You have to just work with what you've got. So you will make slower progress if you've got a dog which just has to run to the back post more frequently, because you won't be able to be practicing your stop and your cast as many times in a session as someone who's got a really drivey dog that can be stopped and cast many times. But that's okay. This isn't a race. You just got to do what you've got to do, and it'll all be worth it in the end when you maintain that stylish outrun from your side. The other tip I would say, if you do have a dog which is starting to show a lack of enthusiasm for running to that back post, is to consider using food. So on this course, I teach you 2 different options for reinforcers that you can use. And we've used these 2 different options all the way through. So the First Steps in Three-Handed Casting course, which precedes this course, also uses food or bumpers as reinforcers. And, you know, for dogs which don't have a lot of retrieving drive and don't want to do rep after rep after rep after rep of retrieves, it can be really helpful to intersperse a retrieve with a food reinforcer in terms of keeping their motivation high. So if you do want to just make that kind of interest in the back post greater, then you can just put some food at the back post or even a tasty chew or something at the back post for a few reps, and you'll see the dog's attitude change and their drive for that back post increase. So that brings me on to another subject in terms of tricky corners of the T-drill. So you don't want the dog to ignore your stop whistle and blast right through to the back post and successfully get a reinforcer at the back post, because they're being reinforced for ignoring your stop whistle. So this means you have to know the dog you've got. And the way the course is laid out is to take you through the least risky options in terms of running these casts. So when we first begin introducing a stop and a cast, we don't put the reinforcer at the back post and we don't cast the dog with a back to the back post. Because if we put the reinforcer, whether it's a bumper or whether it's food, at the back post and the dog ignores our whistle, they're just going to get reinforced for ignoring that whistle, like I said. So on these early casts, we always put the reinforcer or the bumper at the side post, at the left post or at the right post. So that will stop the dog. If the dog does ignore the stop whistle and does blast right through to the back post, they're not going to get reinforced for that because there's nothing there. So we kind of set things up in terms of our positioning of reinforcers as well. We have to think ahead about the moves the dog is likely to make, and we're trying to confound those moves and make sure that we are reinforcing what we want to reinforce. So the course takes you through all of that. What else is there that we talk about on the course? We talk about back casts and how to maintain reliable back casts, whether they're left backs or right backs. And we talk about what happens if the dog overshoots. So they kind of run too far back and then you want to give them a side cast. What happens if the dog stops, but stops with a little kind of U, so they don't stop perfectly on the outrun. They come around. We talk about that. If they kind of banana on the stop a little bit, we move ourselves to be opposite them, which I know is a heinous crime in competition, but at this point of training, when you're just starting out doing these casts, it's more important to keep everything square. So I think I've waffled about this enough, and I hope that I've intrigued some of you, even if what I'm talking about sounds complete gobbledygook and not something you can relate to yet. So if you are at least intrigued, go to my website, forcefreegundog.com, and find the course Training the T-Drill, and look at the video there of Moy, my black Labrador. That was when she was 1 year old, and she's basically running a T-Drill, and that will give you a sense of the exercise itself and what you're kind of aiming for. And if you feel like your dog doesn't have those skills yet, think about which of those skills your dog doesn't have. Is your dog not going to run out that far when you put your hand down and send them to a white post? If so, you need the Blind Retrieves course. Is your dog not going to stop when you blow the whistle and the dog is running fast down the middle of the field? If your dog's not going to stop, then you need the Remote Stop course. Is your dog going to recognize your cast from a distance when you give them a left and a right, or a back left or a back right cast? If so, you need the First Steps in Three-Handed Casting course. So there are those other courses that precede Training the T-Drill, which you need to have under your belt in order to put it all together so it looks like it looks on my website there with Moy running it. So if you want to take advantage of Training the T-Drill, there is a discount, which I think is 20%. It's only available for this week. So you want to grab it. And the discount is the big T. So the T-H-E, big B-I-G and letter T, the big T. That will give you 20% discount on Training the T-Drill. And that discount is only valid for a week. So grab it while you can. And then, because for some reason I was incredibly generous when I set this other discount up, there is a discount on the three feeder courses that you need for Training the T-Drill, which is a 40% discount, and that's available for a month, and I think we're a week into that already, so it's probably like 3 weeks left on that discount. And that discount is T-Drill Prep. So letter T, D-R-I-L-L-P-R-E-P, T-Drill Prep. And that will give you 40% off those three feeder courses that I've mentioned many times. So go check it out. Let's talk about some other things, not about the T-Drill. Okay, folks, it's time for a whistle pause. A whistle pause is when there would usually be an advert from a sponsor. But I don't have a sponsor, so instead I'm going to play you a tune on my trusty Acme 212. Now, the tune there is slightly hampered by the fact that the 212 is just one pitch, but I hope you can appreciate the rhythm. Now, the reason that we've got this beautiful whistle pause instead of an advert is because I didn't get any funding for this podcast or sponsorship. I record it, edit it, upload it myself, and I pay for the server. I don't want to get a sponsor because then I have to promote whatever business is sponsoring me. And apart from the fact that I think that most dog products are bollocks, I would lose some of the independence and the freedom that I have at the moment to say whatever I want to say about whatever I want to say it about. But if you want to support me, and if you like this podcast, then there are some ways that you can support me, which will also benefit you, I hope. So you can check out the online courses I make, which you can find at forcefreegundog.com. And you can also check out my book, Force Free Gun Dog Training, and the accompanying workbook for it, which is a planner called The Workbook. You can get both of these from Amazon wherever you live in the world. So I really hope you can support me and check out some of this material. Anyway, that is the end of today's whistle pause. Let's get back to the show. So I've actually just had an email from Cassandra, which I thought I'd reply to because it's sitting right here. So Cassandra says, "Hi Joe, I have your book. Came to it a bit late. Horse bolted, stable door scenario. We have a lab cross Hunterway." It's quite an interesting combination there. "Came as a pet after our old rescue dog died. I didn't know anything about gun dogs or their jobs, but we did a pet gun dog course for fun, and now I am hooked. We went to a mock novice dog, novice handler working test at the weekend, which was a great opportunity to experience what this entails in a friendly, supportive way. All the new people, dogs, environment blew his mind. None of the tests were beyond him, but the situation affected how he and, of course, me performed. My question is, do you have any suggestions as to how we could get more used to this type of environment without entering a real test? Or do we just have to go for it? Many thanks. Cassandra. P.S. I've been binge listening to your podcast," which is great. Well, hopefully you're going to hear this answer as well then, Cassandra. So, yeah, so basically you just need to have your dog in an environment around other dogs and teach your dog to focus on you. So the good news is that any sort of dog training class is going to achieve this. It doesn't need to be outdoors. It doesn't need to be doing gun dog stuff. You can be inside in a church hall training your dog to walk at heel, pay attention to you, sit, stay around other dogs, do the Kennel Club Kissitism tests. Any sort of pet dog training class is going to meet your needs on this one. So anything that involves teaching your dog to focus on you around and in the presence of other dogs, whatever the environment is. So, and the more that you can do that, the more your dog is just going to take this for granted. So we often get into problems when it comes to contact with other dogs. There are two different ways, there are two different extremes the problems can go to. So one extreme is people don't socialize their dogs with other dogs, and so the dog ends up being reactive towards other dogs because other dogs are scary and they don't understand them and they become reactive towards them. And then the other extreme is people over socialize their dogs probably with other dogs and allow excessive contact with other dogs of a sort of playful, friendly, social way, you know, and dogs end up seeking that out more and more because they find it so reinforcing. So they want to run off at every opportunity to go and greet another dog and play with another dog. And that kind of dog can then be really difficult when you want to have them in a class environment around other dogs and you want them not to be trying to get to the other dogs all the time. And that's probably the situation that it sounds a bit like you're in. So to avoid this, by the way, I know that, you know, your dog is a bit older now, but the best way to avoid this is to really prioritize socialization when your dog is young and within the socialization period. Like, you want your dog to be able to interact with other dogs. And this is particularly important if your dog is an only dog. So I tend to find that dogs which come from multi-dog households and live with other dogs get a lot of that social interaction from the dogs that they live with. They don't necessarily need to interact with loads and loads of other dogs. So you don't need to go overboard with the socialization with those dogs. Whereas dogs which are only dogs probably do need extra socialization with other, you know, other dogs whilst they're young and impressionable and within the socialization period. But then once you've reached the point where you're outside the socialization period, so your puppy is sort of 16 to 20 weeks old or older, and you have, you know, done the good groundwork of giving your puppy good experiences with other dogs, your task really is to prevent direct contact with other dogs, but not to completely avoid other dogs. So you don't want to never let your dog see another dog, but you just need to teach them other dogs are around, we hang out near them, but we focus on training in the presence of other dogs. And that's where continuing going to training classes throughout your dog's sort of adolescence is really, really helpful because your dog is learning to pay attention to you in the presence of other dogs. And, you know, other dogs are around, but they don't have a lot of meaning for your dog because your dog doesn't get to access them and interact with them or play with them. So that's really important for preventing this as well. But yeah, if you find yourself in a situation where you've got a slightly older dog who has been allowed perhaps a bit too much contact with other dogs and is a bit too distracted by it, then, you know, that's ideal, really. Any sort of situation that's going to involve teaching your dog to focus on you in the presence of other dogs will be building those skills. It doesn't need to be a gun dog class, and you don't need to continually enter tests to achieve that. Although there is a slight sort of excitement and edge to tests just because people get a bit anxious, and I think the dogs pick up on that a little bit, and the environment and location is new. So there is something slightly different about tests, but generally the skills are transferable. So that would be my suggestion for that question. And then we had a question from someone else, I can't remember who it's from, on social media, who wanted to know, off the back of my last episode where I was talking about bird contact and how some dogs might need more bird contact than others, and how important it is to be able to provide your dog with the birds that they need for training. And this person wanted to know, did I have any suggestions for being able to achieve that if you live in a situation where you might not live in the middle of nowhere with access to abundant numbers of birds? What can you do? So I do have some suggestions based on my own experience there, because I used to live in central Brighton, which is a city in the south of the UK, and the size of our outdoor area was literally the size of a postage stamp. It was a patio. It had no grass whatsoever. Actually, it was just a small deck, I think. And yeah, we kept quail there in our tiny postage stamp sized yard a couple of times for training purposes. And, you know, we've kept quail since as well. So we can talk a little bit about keeping quail or keeping birds. There are some different options that you want to explore if you're thinking about keeping birds. One is pigeons, and one is bobwhite quail. And then what we've kept, which is very non-ideal, but if you can't find anything else, we had your usual sort of Coturnix Japanese quail. So I'd say explore pigeons, explore bobwhite quail first before the Coturnix or Japanese quail, just because pigeons and bobwhite quail will home back to their aviary, back to your house. So that means that your dog flushes them and they fly off back home happily ever after into their little coop or whatever. And the problem with the Coturnix or Japanese quail is they fly off and they plop. And they don't plop very far away sometimes. They're not great flyers. They have a great little initial burst of energy, but they can't fly properly. So that creates all kinds of problems. It does actually have a slight advantage to it in that you get to practice steadiness to fall as well. But with a young dog, which you're just starting out with the sort of the hunting and the pointing and the steadiness of flush, you don't necessarily want to be practicing steadiness to fall as well. That's kind of, you know, way, way ahead of where you are at that point. So you actually do want birds that fly off. And it's a bit of a problem if they plop down. They also are masters of disguise and can hide themselves incredibly easily. So yeah, it's just non-ideal, really. But if you can't find anything else, then, you know, the Coturnix quail, also called Japanese quail, these are the birds which lay the eggs which you buy in the stores, and they are the quail which people eat. So that's why they're just so, it's just so much easier to find them and to purchase them than it is to find bobwhite quail, which I think actually bobwhite quail are much more available in North America than they are in the UK for some reason. So you want to make sure, by the way, that you've also checked out the legislation around keeping birds, using birds in training, that you're doing things ethically acceptable in, you know, whatever, however you want to deem that, and that you are complying with all the laws and legislations in your country, wherever it is that you live and train, because these are very different the world over as well. So I don't want to advise anyone to do anything which is against the law where you live. So do keep that in mind with everything I say here. So anyway, but in terms of keeping the quail, actually, you know, having them at home, they're very easy to keep. They don't need loads of space. They don't need loads of height. So, you know, you can keep them in a rabbit hutch. Depends how many you have, really. You can keep a few in a rabbit hutch, a large rabbit hutch. They need some grit. They need some breadcrumbs. So quail like finer food than chickens eat. So they need like chick crumb or like crumb, something which is crumbly and smaller and finer than your usual chicken food. They need constant access to water. They need a feeder. And they need, that's about it, really. I mean, they're pretty easy. And they will lay you eggs as well. They're great little layers. And you can eat those eggs. You can feed them to your dogs. We do both. And yeah, they're pretty easy, pretty easy. So I would say the first thing to definitely consider is keeping quail, because then that gives you a lot of training options and you can explore those in more detail and various other ways online. So Googling how to use pigeon or bobwhite quail or quail in training your gun dog is a great way to find lots of ideas. So that's the first thing I'd say. The other thing I would say is find out if there are chutes near you, because if you can start to work your dog on a chute, even if you're just beating with your dog, then you can start to offer your services outside of the season, and your services might involve things like dogging in, like pushing the young birds back into the areas where the feeders are. So that's a way of getting some experience on birds for your dog outside of the shooting season. And, you know, that's very, very useful as well. And generally, the more that you can get involved in things, the more opportunities are going to come your way. But if you don't get involved in things, and if you just hang back and you're your kind of lone force-free trainer who doesn't want to get involved in mainstream activities, then you're going to find it hard to avail yourself of what's out there. So that would be my recommendation. Get involved, explore what birds that you can keep, and yeah, try and see if there are ways that you can make yourself useful to people who do have birds so that you might get invited to I don't know, more stuff, and you might get more opportunities for your dog. Those would be my suggestions on that one.
Hold the line.
That's all for this week, everybody. I am off to do some more work on Force Free Gun Dog Training, the sequel. Da, da, da. All right, that's all for this week, everybody. See you soon.
Hold the line.